Pull up a chair, the stories begin. Patrick and Randy are letting you in. From the desert lights where the big names are, it's Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Welcome to Big Conversations, Little Bar, the Coachella Valley's favorite podcast, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. Get ready for another fascinating hour of meeting people who make the desert city such a spectacular place to be. Now, nestled in their corner booth perch, well lubricated and raring to chat, here's Patrick Evans and Randy Florence.
Well, thank you very much, Howard. We are back here at the corner booth at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert. My name is Patrick Evans, and I'm here with my great friend, spiritual guru.
Thank you. I'm back to being your spiritual guru.
Randy Florence.
Thank you.
The world's greatest sidekick slash co-host next to Ed McMahon.
I haven't passed Ed McMahon yet.
Not yet.
Here's my Johnny.
Here's my Johnny. Yes, there you go. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you,
this
too.
Is the first episode. We're starting our 10th season.
Can you believe it? People have been showing up.
I don't know how we divvy up seasons.
Well, I mean, it's like 3 weeks. One season was 3 weeks, and the next season was 30 weeks.
I think
and
5 episodes a season, so we can get a lot of seasons. I don't know.
Well, we're up to almost 100. What, John?
That's not true. We're almost at 150. It's generally, we measure them in like 13-week increments.
Not just the good shows.
Okay. Oh, we count the bad ones, too?
They're all in
it's
that
count. It's really important to do that. It is.
You learn your best
we've
lessons.
We've only had three.
Maybe four.
Maybe four.
Maybe four.
One of them was bad enough that it was like two.
One didn't ever make air. We should give a shout out to the McCallum Theater.
McCallum Theater has been one of our sponsors, and another fantastic season going on right now.
You know, they just, at the end of last year, they wrapped up the Gift of Love concerts with Barry Manilow.
John was telling us all about those.
Yeah, I went and saw the show, and it was really great. And then, of course, it was very sad when just a few days later they announced that Barry had been diagnosed with lung cancer.
Yeah. But they say it's super treatable. So we send our love to Barry and Gary Keefe. And
there weren't four extra tickets in your envelope, were there?
There weren't.
Okay. He was sitting alone in the balcony.
Gary was in the booth.
No, Gary and John. They were just the two of them.
Actually, there were like five seats next to me.
Oh, don't even go there. Hey, before we get started on the show, I do want to talk about a change for you because the Valley needs to know you're not just this unbelievable podcaster. You've got a couple of other things you do in town. A
couple of other cases, yes.
And one of those is your radio show. You've got some changes coming up.
Yeah, we just made a big move. And some of it's kind of esoteric, but we were on 103.1 MeTV FM. That format went away, and now if you love KG Radio, you can listen to them at 103.1.
Are you upset that it's not Me TV anymore?
No.
Did you name
it's gonna
that?
It's called MePatrick.com.
Me Patrick Radio.
I did secure the domain name ThePatrickEvans.com.
Were you? I lost my sound there.
But my wife doesn't know that, so don't tell her.
Were you afraid that somebody else was going to take it?
Yeah, there's another Patrick Evans, and he takes up a lot of these things. I just steal it. We've just debuted a brand new station. It's called Sunny 106.5, and we are playing the hits 90s, 80s, 90s, 2000s. So it's still technically oldies.
You know I have my list of...
But it's kind of the oldies we grew up with.
My requests.
Yeah, okay. We're going to set up a text line, so you'll be able to text me your requests.
Do I have to go in through the general public, or can I come directly to you?
No, you can text me directly. I can ignore your text, whether they come to the station or me directly. It's fine. Doesn't bother me.
Full service ignore.
Yeah. It's like that.
Hey, let's start our podcast.
So let's do that, because we have a really special guest.
We
whom
do.
You've been stalking since the days you lived in Idlewild.
Yes. Yes.
That's how you two...
There was one day, our guest, Sharon Lawrence.
Hello.
Usually I get 5 minutes into the questions before I announce who the guest is.
Well, I would not have been able to hold back my laughter any longer. You would have heard me before I was introduced because you all are, you know how to entertain each other.
Thank
and
you.
The rest of us too.
That's it. We can entertain each other.
It's actually kind of how it started. Difficult. Yeah. Yeah. We've only had a couple of return guests.
We're delighted to have you. I'm super excited.
Thank you.
Super excited. Randy was like, hey, would you like to have Sharon Lawrence on the podcast? I'm like, are you kidding me?
So maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I'm posting something on Instagram while we had our house up in Idlewild, Kay and I. And I don't know, I hashtagged Idlewild or something. And I get a phone call from my son. And he goes, oh my God, Sharon Lawrence just commented on your post. And I'm like, well, yeah, you sound surprised. He has not recovered to this day from your death on NYPD Blue. He still talks about that to this day.
Wow. How old was he when he was watching? That was 30.
Well, he's almost 50 now, so hard to believe. I have a 50-year-old son.
30 years ago. Wow.
Right. We had our 30th anniversary. I guess it was 2023. That was when the show debuted, and it ran for 12 seasons. Yeah. But he's talking about season 6, which is when Sylvia met her demise in a courthouse with a bullet to the solar plexus. And
that was a rough day for all of us.
It was a tough one. Yeah, it was so interesting shooting that because we were not on the Fox lot. We were downtown at a soundstage that had a courtroom that a lot of different studios would rent. And we started early that day, and I literally left that set and went to the table read for my new job, which was a sitcom with Alfred Molina and Betty White and Steven Root and Kaley Cuoco. So I remember it, but it was the end of, didn't really feel like the end of something as much as it just felt
like.
Because
you just rolled right on to that.
I did go into something.
Were you still bloody from the fake packet?
No, but I do think I walked away with some cakes, you know, celebratory. our happy trails, that's sort of what we, in the entertainment business, we don't say goodbye. We just sing happy trails to each other. And know that we'll meet again. And of course, I've spent plenty of time with a lot of those cast members. And we missed Stephen Bochco. He was such an impresario and left his mark in a way that will always be powerful and evergreen.
Your path has crossed with, I mean, just, well, you are one of those, but just with some of the greatest people in television, the most talented. You mentioned Stephen Bochco.
Point that right at your face, Randy. Let's get a close-up.
Thank you. No, I don't think anybody would want to see that.
You're talking about little cameras, tiny little cameras.
Yeah, little tiny cameras I'm not used to seeing around here.
This is new. We're trying something new.
Yeah. We're only 145 episodes in, but we think we're going to get this down pretty quickly.
We think this video thing is going to stick. I feel like it's cutting edge. Like, people like moving images.
They do. You don't have to have it, though. I mean, when you're driving, of course, I'm glad it's just the audio, which, by the way, I'm going to contribute to the audio.
Enjoy your beer.
My first gulp of a beer here at the little bar.
Well, if it's a really good show, it won't be the last. We've gotten several people pretty hammered on this show.
Yeah, that's one of our claims to fame. Yeah, absolutely. And we had one guest, and I'm not going to name names. One guest actually ate his lunch through the entire show.
Oh my gosh!
We had to edit out a lot of sloppy food sounds.
Yeah, that was not that was one of the four,
that
wasn't
was
it?
One of our greatest hits. All right, we will of course come back because there's a wealth of material there with NYPD Blue. But I want to talk about what was most meaningful to me, which was
share your tattoo first.
I'm waiting with bated breath, please. Right. Oh my gosh!
I'm kind of a nut.
Oh,
when it comes to Star Trek.
Star Trek. Wow!
And you starred in an episode of Star Trek Voyager.
Yes.
It was a little bit of a time throwback. An episode called The 37s, and you played Amelia Earhart.
Yes, I did. Who had been cryogenically frozen in space with several other iconic and randomly selected individuals, a farmer from the Dust Bowl era, and Genghis Khan, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. Can you help me remember who else it might have been?
Oh, gosh.
Well, Fred... Amelia Earhart's co-pilot, and yeah, they were frozen together. And what was the storyline was not only explaining her disappearance, that she had been abducted by aliens and cryogenically frozen, but they thawed her out. And she was, of course, Captain Janeway, played so beautifully by Kate Mulgrew. Amelia Earhart was plenty of aviatrix's heroes.
Right, and she was certainly one of Captain Janeway's
heroes. Yes, and in the process of Amelia Earhart recognizing how far humanity had advanced and the technological shifts and how thrilling it is for her, they offer to drop her off at a planet that is very much like Earth. And Janeway says, you could come with and be my co-pilot. Amelia Earhart has been longing for terra firma, and she thanks her, but turns down the offer.
Yeah, it was kind of a bittersweet moment.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
I thought the whole series was terrific. I thought Kate Mulgrew was not your only Star Trek crossover, though. You did a pilot with William Shatner. Boston Legal.
Oh, that's right. That was the pilot episode, right? And it went on to be a series.
Right.
But
yes.
I was only in that one episode. Yeah. Yes, he was great.
Yeah,
he was so much fun.
Very cool.
He surely is. And so was Kate. It was really a thrill to work with her because I had been such a fan of hers on a soap opera called Ryan's Hope.
Oh yeah,
and she played Mrs. Columbo too.
Yes, she did. She gets around because she's that good. She's so good. And we shot the vantage point of the Earth-like planet that the Voyager had landed on in a very unique place in Los Angeles. It's a hiking area in Beechwood Canyon, and there's a trail that's a fire road that I hiked a lot before I ever got a job on television, for about 6 months when I'd moved from New York and before NYPD Blue happened and before the Voyager job. So it was my neighborhood and I knew it well. But there's a little switchback in that area where the Batcave from Batman is.
Oh, yeah.
As the Batmobile peels out, and that's where we shot the landing for the Voyager.
Wow.
Became a process shot that they CGI'd the Starcraft yeah. into. But that's what we're looking out over. Yeah.
Well, that's so awesome.
We used to live off of Beechwood. And so I've taken the kids to see the Batcave.
Mm-hmm.
You got to take me there. That would fascinate me.
It doesn't look anything like it did on television.
Does Adam West hang out?
Yeah, no, he's gone.
No.
Burt Ward is still with us.
Burt? I'm pretty much the Burt Ward of the podcast, I think.
you are.
But that makes you Adam West.
Well, it does. It's okay. Adam West was a cool guy. I'm amazed that you remember so much detail because it was one episode, and I imagine it was like you were just like, okay, this is another good job. This looks like a fun script.
I remember so much about it. I remember that being the only second time I'd ever been on the Paramount lot. The first time was an episode of Cheers.
Mm.
I played a member of a sex addicts group that was the second to the last episode of the entire series.
That was such a fantastic
episode.
Now
right?
I'm going to go
because
back and watch
Ted
that.
Hits on, yeah, he hits yeah. on my character, you know, right. Even in a sex addict group, he just can't help himself. And the Star Trek building, which was, I guess, the Gene Roddenberry building, was one of the older buildings on the lot. And that certainly sticks with me. That and the terrible wig that I wore as Amelia Earhart was a pretty bad wig.
It was pretty bad wig.
Yeah, pretty bad wig.
But Star Trek is well known for bad hair
pieces. Bad hair pieces. Well, William Shatner is well known for bad hair pieces.
But working with their special effects makeup guys was really thrilling, too, because they had to give me that frosty look, that frozen
oh that's right
yeah cadavered type skin tone. And yeah, those things don't happen every day. So of course I remember it. And I went to my first fan convention ever last year.
Was it really? Comic-Con?
No, it wasn't Comic-Con. What was it called? I can't remember that. But there were dolls. Somebody made a doll for the Amelia Earhart character. And it was great to have conversations with people. I'd love to do more of those because I had such a good experience. I had resisted it because I just didn't know what to expect. And hadn't had time, frankly. But I did have that window. And
they must have gone crazy seeing you there,
well,
Sharon.
Those who love that world certainly do. And I love the cards that they've made up for Amelia.
Star Trek fans are fanatics. And like even a one guest shot makes you part of that world.
Yes.
And I'm sure you get lots of invitations to conventions, and it's kind of a cool thing. Before that, though, you said that was shortly after you moved from New York, but you were doing a lot of Broadway prior
yes.
to that.
Yes, yeah, I was a musical theater.
You started on Broadway, didn't you?
Well, yes, that's where I was first paid. Let's put it this way. The first jobs that I was paid for were in musicals. It was summer stock.
Yeah.
You know, when you're coming up, if you're lucky, like I have been, and luck in my estimation, meaning when opportunity meets preparation, you are not given opportunities until you're ready. So I got to play leads in summer stock companies, which was the right path for me because I got a lot of experience in situations where everyone is still evolving, everyone is still learning.
Yeah.
And I can't say I started on Broadway, but when I got to Broadway, I was totally ready and never overwhelmed and completely
comfortable
at
on
home.
Stage.
Oh, yeah. I'd always been comfortable on stage, but the stakes get higher and higher when you're working with people like Anthony Quinn, my first big Broadway.
It was a revival
of Zorba.
Zorba.
Right. And I played opposite him. I was the woman that he pays to spend the evening with him, and he wastes a lot of the money that his boss, who has asked him to be the guide in Greece for this new mining venture, and he spends more of the money than he should have on A Lady of the Night. And so that was my role, and I tangoed with Anthony Quinn eight times a week. Tango.
That's incredible.
With one of the biggest stars in the world.
Right.
And because I was confident in my abilities to deliver, that didn't intimidate me. It excited me.
So. I'm fascinated with how people get to that point of being comfortable in those situations. So let's go all the way back to the beginning. You're born in North Carolina?
Right.
Big family?
I come from a large extended family, but there are only myself and my brother in my nuclear family. But it's not just being born in North Carolina, it's being born into a family of storytellers. My father was a broadcaster, but before he became a broadcaster, and by that I mean on two of the biggest television CBS affiliates in the Southeast, he studied at Northwestern journalism, but also acting because he had done outdoor drama in North Carolina, a very famous, still, I think it's maybe close to 75 years old, an outdoor drama called The Horn in the West about Daniel Boone in a town, Boone, North Carolina. And many of that side of my family they're storytellers or performers in some way. Never a professional, except for my dad and my aunt, because they were paid to do The Horn in the West. And nobody decided to make it a career until I did decide to do it, but my degree's in journalism from UNC Chapel Hill, because I did think that would be my path.
An ACC girl.
Well,
I went to Virginia, so we're natural rivals.
Yes, we are. And because I was
thing working out for
I should have said that was something I'd like to stay away from.
Usually, we wait right till the end before you piss off one of our guests.
I
don't care who it is. I wish we spent as much money on academics as we did on sports. That's my point of view, my position on it.
So tell me about that. I'm fascinated. Storytellers. How did that look around the house? I mean, were there gatherings and people just started telling stories?
And they all had great timing.
Yeah.
My parents met in choir, so they both had great voices, and singing was just part of what we did. And I got the hardware from them and the software, because I do think that there are certain gifts that people are given. You guys have great voices, and it's anatomical as much as it is a skill set. And I got that from my mom and my dad. I was a natural singer, and I heard a lot of great comic timing. People knew how to tell stories. They liked entertaining each other. And Christmases were filled with people singing around the piano and making each other laugh and understanding timing and punchlines. And it was a very wholesome group, too. There was not...
Sounds kind of like a Hallmark movie.
They met in choir, so it's got to be... It's pretty wholesome.
And it wasn't just a choir. It was a Mars Hill Junior College. So they got in trouble for my dad's arm being behind my mother's back on a rock wall. But... My grandmother, who I sadly never met, she died right after my mother. I think she was only carrying me for about a month or so. She died on an operating table, you know, just a medical mistake.
Oh.
And she had the gift of gab. She was in the debate clubs, and she was part of the elocution group. So I bring her in, and her name was Florence.
Aww.
She was Florence Elizabeth Johnson. I'm Sharon Elizabeth Lawrence. And when she married Charles Ray Lawrence, she became Florence Lawrence. No kidding.
It's so funny because we used to joke with our sons that we were going to name them Horace and Lawrence.
Yeah.
Florence. They were so glad that we didn't.
Right.
That's fascinating.
And my brother doesn't have that same wiring. He's wired differently.
What does he do?
It works for a really fascinating company called SAS, Statistical Analysis Systems, out of Carrboro, North Carolina. It's a global statistical analysis company, and he does all their media. So he travels the world capturing conferences and Jim Goodnight's gift to the world with his knowledge and his entrepreneurial prowess, and that's my brother Mark, and he was a great cameraman in the newsroom for a while, but he liked that corporate world, and he's done really well there. So he's behind the scenes.
Very different paths for you.
Very different paths. Yeah, both media,
both
telling stories, just in
different ways.
In a different way. My dad was in the news business for, I guess, 50 years.
Which station was he at?
WBTV in Charlotte and WRAL in Raleigh.
Oh, yeah.
It's not the CBS affiliate anymore, at least not in Raleigh. It is. It's the Fox affiliate.
Yeah, they changed.
They did. They did.
Several little periods where affiliations kind of rolled around.
Right. Yeah. It's still owned by the Goodman family, but you know, they think things are constantly changing. And I knew I was a good singer, and I knew I was a good dancer. And I knew that's where I was comfortable. Don't ask me to catch a ball. That really scared me. I have none of that. And I was glasses.
So you weren't playing basketball with James Worthy.
No.
There goes the second half of our podcast.
Yeah, sorry. I didn't
She
get
knew
that.
James Worthy, so I wanted to
I
get
did.
Into that
oh.
conversation,
I did.
Too.
I did. Yeah. I'm really coordinated. And Tom, my husband, tried to teach me to play tennis because he played tennis for Michigan State. But what I don't have is he could teach me. I have got great strokes, but I am not competitive. I just have no drive to get to the ball no matter what. I don't thrill at winning. As a matter of fact, it kind of makes me uncomfortable. I'm a team player.
So but how does that look in your career?
That's exactly the question. Yeah. Because it's a competitive business.
Right.
But we are competing with the best version of ourselves, I think. Are we as good as our last gig? Are we as good as we can be? But I never believed that if I didn't get a job, it was because someone else scored more points than I did. Because my work is subjective, not objective. Right. And it's obvious when you've won or lost a game or a race. And my dad drove sports cars competitively. And I drove competitively a little bit. So you know when you've won or lost, it's clear. But not with the arts. It's subjective.
Yeah.
And if that was me telling myself a story just to to stay emotionally and mentally healthy, that's okay. But I've also sat on the other side of the table as a producer, and I know for a fact that there are 15 people out of 30 that we could cast that would be great, but it's about a fit with everything else. So being the right fit for that story, that composition, is truly what matters whether you get the gig or not.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's the truth.
You also spent some time on the World Poker Tour.
Well,
that sounds kind of competitive.
It was. it was not where I felt the most comfortable. The best time I ever played was when Tom and I were coming back from Paris for a friend's wedding, and I was jet lagged, and I didn't have that much adrenaline to get concerned about whether or not I'd play well. And somehow math started to make more sense to me. And I did better than I had ever done. But I just don't care that much about winning. Yeah. I don't. You'll hear me screaming for my team. I love being excited about my team. But I don't carry it with me when we don't win. And I don't even carry the win, the bragging rights, much beyond when it happens.
Got it.
I have a lot. My loyalty is to the effort and to a team ethic and a team spirit. That's really what I'm good at.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Must make you a delight on the set.
I bet.
Because not everybody's wired like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know what else I discovered? Of course, everyone aspires. If you have, and I'm not saying that I don't have an ego. I loved playing leads, right? You love when you're tapped, when you're chosen, and you get to feel what that's like, because as you're coming up, you wonder what it's like until you experience it and you know whether or not you feel equipped to do that and that you can be of service. And does it charge you up or does it drain you? Both things can be true. However, in doing that, it gave me a real appreciation for the unique experience of being in an ensemble and carrying an ensemble moment live when we all break into the same dance move at the same time. And that must be like being in a moment with a sports team when everybody's like Phil, you know, Dean Smith's Four Corners, that when I was at Caroline at the 80s, as they were a mind meld,
right,
that you don't get when you're in a solo
I
situation.
I hated those Four Corners. He ruined the last 4 minutes of a basketball. You go to the
I love games that end 18 to 16.
Right,
those are awesome.
Life right out of
you. It's like, okay, well, now we can just wait.
You know, there's a famous restaurant, there was, in Chapel Hill named the Four Corners, which is one of the best places to go. Because,
really?
Yeah, you know, that was a sacred thing
that
we created and had bragging rights to.
That's true.
Or when you're singing with a harmony, you can't harmonize with yourself.
That's the
best. It just changes your chemistry. So I always go back to that feeling.
We're going to take a very quick
break. Let's take a break.
Because we have to thank our sponsor, the McCallum Theater. We want to hear from them. But we will be right back with more with Sharon Lawrence. This is super fun.
It's wonderful. It's marvelous. You should care.
And we are back. Our thanks again to the McCallum Theater. McCallumtheater.org. Get your tickets. The season is going strong. We're here with Sharon Lawrence, and kudos to you, Randy. I almost called you Andy.
Aw.
As long as I'm sitting here, I don't really care.
Okay. All right, well, Andy and I are just delighted to have you.
Okay, Atrick, let's move
Andy.
On.
I hear Andy, and I think Andy Sipowicz. I'm in my PD Blue.
Oh, see name. How close we are?
Yeah. Well, I let him do all the research, but I was doing some modest research, and I'd totally forgotten that you guys got married on the show.
Yes. We were not just hooking up. We made it official, and we had a baby, right? That Theo.
Yeah.
And we got married. Sylvia, I've told this story before. Sylvie was not part of the original concept of the show. The character that I played was written for a man. It was an assistant district attorney. And we know that it was written for a man because the script's line, the famous line that Sipowicz says to this attorney who has humiliated him in a courtroom while he's hungover and misbehaving, he chases the attorney down in the hallway and calls him a pissy little bastard. Well, someone in the Botchko world, I'm pretty sure it was a woman, realized there weren't enough women populating the world that NYPD Blue was creating, whether it was in the squad room or the courthouse or just in the pages of the script. So they said, let's make this a woman. Why not? And I auditioned with several other women. I got it. And the character was just ADA. And of course, he called this character not something other than a bastard. Can we say it on,
yes.
This, on bitch? He calls her a bitch, yeah. As he grabs his junk. This very rude move. Well,
Andy Sipowicz was such a seminal character.
I know.
I mean, just so memorable for kind of just that gritty,
right.
Rude. But it
out
was,
of control, right. And especially then, because he was at the height of his alcoholism. And they liked what they saw so much in that sequence. They realized it told the story, circling back, in a way that compelled them more than the first scene that was in the script as written, and they decided to make that the teaser of the show, because David Caruso's character is also sitting in that courtroom,
wow.
Reacting, and you understand their relationship, you understand who people are. There's a mob figure who's there, which raises the stakes. And Sipowicz being such a wild card, and the pressurization of the internal world of these police officers when they're not out there in the field, it's still combustible. And they wanted to make it part of the, they made it the teaser, and they also wanted it to go from an inside of a small space to the outside world on the streets of New York. So they flew us to New York to shoot that sequence again outside at 100 Center Street, which is the courthouse downtown. And they saw Dennis and I hanging out at the craft service table, just enjoying each other. And they had seen me out of costume, sort of, you know, more like Sharon, the dancer in me, just the feminine, fun, girlish part of me. And they thought, we could start somewhere and end somewhere.
Because it would bring out a side of him that there was no other way they were going to be able to get into.
Oh, no, it gave him
that's a great
art.
Yeah. Right, that's how you fell in love with Andy, is through her eyes.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Mm-hmm. Talk about, I mean, that's an iconic show.
Well, it was really a groundbreaking show.
Yes.
And it seemed like at the time it was the most realistic look at a police show.
Since Hill Street, and it's the same group of people.
Right. Yeah.
And they knew that, and they brought on real cops, of course. And David Milch, we knew he had a way of creating language and scenarios that pulled you in, and the cast was so fantastic.
Was it a role that you knew right away you wanted, and then the hope that it was going to grow?
Oh, I never saw any of that coming.
She's not competitive. So.
No, that's true.
No, I never saw any of that coming. How could you possibly see that coming? You hope that if you're there for a day, that you've made an impression. But you never know how that's going to reveal itself or to unfold. And when they built Sylvia, when I saw in the script that Andy comes to Sylvia's apartment, which means they were building a set, then I knew they were making an investment in this character. That's right. Expensive to build a character set.
And that won you, what, three Emmy nominations?
Yes, that was three Emmy nominations, right. Right. Three out of the... There are more, but they
came
from different shows.
And a SAG Award, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
SAG Award, right. I'm very proud of that.
At that point in your career, were Were you confident that I am a income achieving actress? I don't have to worry about, or was every job, oh my God, I hope I get this?
It's rare that I hope I don't get something, but I can also let go pretty quickly because I've done pilots that didn't go, and right. you get invested and you picture yourself because you've signed your life to that for 5 years. So I was shooting a series in Vancouver when 9/11 happened, and it was way before the vampire shows were out. This was a series about werewolves, and it was really good. The guys that did Carnival for HBO, Tim Matheson and Mia Kirshner and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. It was really interesting, yeah. called Wolf Lake. And boy, I really wanted that to go. I was the head of the pack, the female werewolf, and it was really interesting storytelling set in the Pacific Northwest. And this family that was this lumber dynasty, and could have been so great. But when the world changed for all of us, we all knew that nothing is as, it's not very important. I was doing radio interviews when I saw the second tower, the second plane hit the second tower. You know,
everything changed.
Everything changes. Yeah. So I do let go quickly. I'm good at that.
Was there ever a chance that that was going to get brought back at another time?
It was dark. Yeah. It was dark. And then by the time Vampire Diaries from my friend, Kevin Williamson's Julie Pleck, those folks, that group of fairly talented writers, I guess, you know, the world had moved on in a way, and Paul Wesley, who is now, was my son in Wolf Lake, and you can still find Wolf Lake, because I think we had maybe 10 episodes aired, I think. He went on to have a great career. But things coming back, you know what I wish, the one that really hurts is Joe Pickett, my most recent big series regular role, because we were going to have a season 3. But there was plenty of material. There are 26 novels, and it's a fantastic character, and I loved being in Calgary where we shot, and the cast was amazing. But we had two things happen, which is the shutdown of our industry for our union's action, that several of the all of the union's action, and then the contraction of the industry. And Paramount was our studio, and Paramount knew that they were not really clear what their path was going to be. As we've seen, it continues to unfold.
So that one's
hard.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because I mean, back in the days of NYPD Blue, was that a 26 episode season?
22.
Yeah, so just don't do that anymore.
No. Now it's 8 episodes,
I mean,
and everybody's
you're lucky
worn
to get
out.
8 or 10. but the, you know, obviously the streaming incursion into your business, and I mean, there's all of these platforms and they need content, but now there's this merger process happening, and you know, Paramount's eating up this and looking at Warner Brothers and Netflix's. I mean, so talk about how that's changed, because TV is different, and now you're lucky to get 3 seasons where you guys had 12. You know.
And my husband and I were just talking about this. What all the convergence of so many factors and prestige television, which we were all living through, which was, I think, it's quoted as 2020 to 2023. And that's interesting because it straddles a pandemic. Mm-hmm. And people were still making good television. We were shut down for a while, but I did the first Christmas House movie on Hallmark, which was such a huge hit and such a seminal movie, because the first gay or same-sex kiss was in that film. And Treat Williams and myself played parents to Jonathan Bennett and Robert Buckley. And we were invited to do a second one, but we shot that first one in August of that first pandemic year. So people were working after that. It was a struggle, but we were doing it. And shows like Breaking Bad, there's so many that we can talk about that created what it's called prestige TV, was also the time where there was a glut of television. There was so much product that these tech companies had invested heavily to try to keep up with Netflix. But if you didn't have the platform with an algorithm, you were making things that weren't necessarily going to garner the same amount of eyeballs. So it was an adjustment within our industry. But that also has meant that rather than four broadcast networks, let's say Fox, because it was coming up right when NYPD Blue was starting, from three to four. Now, I mean, I can't count how many streamers there are, how many opportunities. And as we all know, none of them are catching the kind of eyeballs that YouTube does.
Right.
Right? So you can, and now we have another version of what you can watch and what you can find on your phone called verticals, which is basically storytelling in little minute-sized episodes that it was made popular in Asia, and it's shot for the phone vertical format so that it's easy to watch while you're walking your dog or whatever, and it's only a minute long, and you can see them for free up until the last few episodes, and that's when they've hooked you in, and you'll pay in a pretty high rate to be able to...
It's like a heroin dealer.
The story is like a heroin dealer, yeah. And our union has made a deal with this type of work because we know we cannot exclude any version of what it means to be an actor on camera.
Well, you
and we want the YouTube influencers and part of our union too.
Yeah. You can't leave behind that audience.
No.
I mean, I look at the way my children, who are now 17 and 20, when I watched how they watched television, and you know, I work in broadcast news. And I like, I knew then, you know, 15 years ago, I'm in trouble because they don't watch TV the way we watched TV.
Right.
And, you know, it's all about the platform and it is about shorter attention spans and garnering those eyeballs. So there's more diversification yet to come. But all of those streamers, you know, everybody's getting a little sliver of the audience. No one's getting the kinds of numbers that you know, those big network shows did.
And here's something that I think people forget or don't really understand. Our unions merged the Screen Actors Guild, which is the oldest union is the actors, the Actors Equity, the stage union. And we were created because back in the 1890s, actors were not allowed to be buried in church cemeteries. We were such persona non grata.
Wow.
So actors band together. Edwin Booth, John Wilkes Booth, who, of course, was the famous for assassinating President Lincoln. They were both actors. They came from an acting family. He and Edwin Booth and his compatriots had their first meeting at his brownstone in Gramercy Park, where the famous Players Club exists now. And I was in his private bedroom chamber where he passed, and in the room where the first Actors Equity meeting exists. It's great history. But then Screen Actors Guild came along because it covered the motion picture, the film work. And then after was radio, television, and the American Federation of Radio and Television Actors, when television was live and live to tape. And that was talk shows, game shows, news broadcasts. And we merged because for a while we were paid separately in different rates because nighttime television and film, films that you'd see in movie theaters were captured on celluloid. So the medium was what determined how you were paid and who had the jurisdiction. And then along came digital. And the studios and networks understood that they had an advantage there.
Yeah.
That they could go to both of the unions and say, we're going to go with who gives us the better deal because neither film nor tape will make a difference.
Right.
And you all will have to negotiate amongst yourselves on who's going to get the business. So we merged to be able to hold our position. It was a compromise, but we had to do that. So
Very knowledgeable, but how involved are you with the union?
I'm on the SAG-AFTRA Foundation board. That's our philanthropic arm. We run several programs. We're 40 years old this year. We have our catastrophic health coverage if someone is diagnosed with a catastrophic illness that will keep them from working and earning the money that they need to qualify for coverage. We help take care of that. Emergency assistance, which we have been offering for 40 years. We raised $1.2 million for the LA fire. And those people who are in our union who needed assistance.
And there were a lot of them in that.
There
area.
Were a lot of them. And, and that money, we've distributed it all. You know, they were getting $5,000 grants, one, and then they could come back for another one. We have our, we had scholarship programs for actors who were putting their kids through school so they could apply for scholarships. And that means we hire professionals that are helping us, social workers and educational specialists who help us with these grants. And our educational offering, which is a literacy program called Storyline Online, beloved children's books that are read by beloved actors. And we reach all across the globe. And we are not just two Emmy nominations of quality programming, but we have so many episodes now that we reach literally millions of preschoolers, and that's typically educators use us, parents use us.
And nowadays that's becoming more and more important, right? Because there's more options being taken away from them,
right?
For the kids.
And we offer continuing education to our members. We've got a great voiceover lab, the Don LaFontaine Voiceover Laboratory. Yes. If you're not familiar with his name, who wants to do the famous LaFontaine line? Do you know?
Randy knows it.
I don't know the line. What's the line?
It's the front of the top of so many trailers, in a world. It's him. That's Don
in
LaFontaine,
a world.
Who sadly gone, but he made such an impact on our industry and on those pros that now our laboratory, where people train and come in and do their voiceover auditions, or I did a voiceover narration for a documentary for the Ten Chimneys, which is a theater. That's another story altogether. Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine had their own estate, and they were the first couple of American theater back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, all the way to the 60s when they retired. And there's a program for actors in the third quarter of their career. 10 actors get to come in the summer for a week and study with a master teacher.
Wow.
We did a documentary, and I recorded the voiceover narration for that there.
Do you like voiceover work?
I do. I'd love to do more of it.
Oh, man,
it would
you've
be
got
a lot
the voice
of fun.
For it.
Do we?
Oh, yeah.
That's really kind of you to say. Thank you. People that are doing books on tape, audiobooks. We do audition classes there. We have so many of the people who are debuting their films will come and screen it at our beautiful Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson screening room in the Merrill Street Center. We'll have career retrospectives. George Clooney's just done a big one for us. And people like George Clooney and Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks have really been our supporters. Are the high net worth individuals have really stepped up.
Those are some names that might get some things done.
Right, yeah.
The Idyllwild community, when we were living there, we found that there were a lot of previous entertainers, actors, actresses. Bonnie Bedelia had a... Did I pronounce that right?
Bedelia. No.
She had a home there, and at one point they had done a little local theater, and she actually got involved. So I just wondered if you've ever seen any of that in Idlewild.
And our dear friend Tom and I are very close to a wonderful actor named Connor O'Farrell, who you've seen. He was in the Pearl Harbor. What was that? The Pacific. That's what it was called. The Pacific, not Pearl Harbor. He was in that. He did a lot of stage at the Taper. He was in NYPD Blue. We did a series together called Game of Silence, and he's an Idyllwild resident. And he would put together plays that they would do at the Rustic Theater.
Yeah.
And typically comedies, because that's really what worked.
Yes.
And it was so exciting to support that. And
it's such a great little town.
Yeah.
I love
your favorite restaurant up there's got to be Cafe Aroma.
Oh, it doesn't have to be. I love Aroma, but
could be Farrow's.
It could be Farrow's.
Oh, Farrow's is very good too.
You bet it could be. It could be Fratello's, which has really delicious Italian food.
Hey, I like a good Mexican meal there at La Casita.
Yeah, La Casita is great. There are There's so many to choose from. Yeah. I love the Sunshine Bakery. They've got great baked goods, the Raven's Bagels.
I hadn't heard of that. Yes.
And I'm sorry that.
That's okay. That's the place to get the bagels up there. Huh?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Check their hours so you'll, you know, won't be disappointed. But they'll, not only can you buy them, you know, in bulk, right? A dozen, a half dozen, but they'll make sandwiches out of them that are fantastic. This morning we had lox on ours, which is what made me think, oh, I'll get them for you. We'd already left, but make a trip up there.
We will.
And
we
just
will
check the hours. Raven
Bagels.
Because
you liquidated your very handsome estate up there.
We did.
To fund your foundation.
That was fun the rest of my life.
Oh,
really.
Okay. All right.
My foundation. My bagel foundation. Yeah.
You know, there's no stoplight. It's mom and pops establishments. As people may have heard, the mayor is a golden retriever.
Yeah.
Really, it's the Chamber of Commerce that is sort of the overarching body that watches out for things.
Yeah.
But during the pandemic, a lot of people discovered it. And the prices are, you know, I hope
yes.
you got out at the right time. So good for you. That means that
late 2021.
Okay,
yeah.
Smart. You timed your life well. That's good.
Yeah,
that's good.
But there is not a day that goes by that I don't wish we still had that home and that I could spend some time up there.
Well, now you can do Airbnbs and you can get a taste of it with them.
What's coming up for you?
What is coming up? Well, we talked about stage, the challenges in the film industry.
Yeah.
I did a Hallmark Christmas movie this year set at the Grand Ole Opry, and that was really fun.
Oh.
That's called A Grand Ole Opry Christmas, and I was in Jonathan Bennett's Finding Mr. Christmas, Jonathan being a Palm Springs resident,
yes.
he and his husband, James Vaughn. I was the flower girl at their wedding,
oh, wow.
which makes me one of their honorary moms.
And he has
so
a nice connection to one of our previous guests, Ron Oliver, who directs quite a few Hallmark movies.
Yes.
You know Ron.
Yes. And I'm very honored to be part of that world because they really know how to bring people together, and I think we need that sort of uplifting storytelling. While people think it's so predictable, you know you're gonna feel good at the end of the movie, and that means a lot these days. You can count on that when so much is uncertain. A lot of people who work in really challenging situations. Hospitals, first responders, they say they what they have playing at their home is Hallmark because of the quality.
There's only one purpose for it.
Yes.
Make
and
me
yet
feel
they've
better.
Opened the world up to
yeah.
a lot of European locations.
But they shoot on some wonderful locations.
Yeah, you know, it's all right, it's good.
And they're all beauty shots. I mean it's
right, like, right, right. But I'm also been very busy on stage. I've been playing Catherine Graham in a solo play for about 5 years. She was the publisher of the Washington Post
yeah.
during the Watergate yeah. and the Pentagon era. I feel drawn to it because my degree was journalism, my father being a journalist.
And she was the strongest person in every room she was in.
Not originally.
No.
She came from a very privileged background, but was very insecure. She had a very critical, demanding mother, and her marriage was difficult. She was very much in love with her brilliant but troubled husband, Phil Graham. Her husband owned the paper. It was her family's paper.
Right.
But in 1948, when they married, no one would ever allow a woman to run a paper. Her father made Phil the publisher. Sadly, he suffered from bipolar disorder. And back in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, it was very challenging to treat that disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his own life in 1963 in their country home. And 3 days later, she went to the board of directors. She was the only woman in the room right. and remained the only woman on the board for decades. And made the announcement that she was going to run the paper herself to keep it in the family. But she was, until, according to her dear friend Warren Buffett, an advisor, Warren Man. Buffett, always felt that she was never quite measuring up. She got more and
really?
More confident,
yeah.
and she learned to play the part. But she was the victim of a domestic type of oppression, And often that accompanies a disease like bipolar disorder that, that can't be
medicated. How did you find this play?
I was approached by the playwright who was part of the Ojai Playwrights Conference. And she knew that I'd come from a journalism family or background and asked if I knew who Kay Graham was. Indeed, I did. And she said, would you read this play? And because I had been part of the leadership of women in film for so long, I say yes to women all the time, no matter what stage they are in their career or what stage the project is. It's one of my guiding sort of missions is to say yes to women because we can't do these projects alone. And it was one of the best yeses I have ever given. My another one was to Ava DuVernay with her first feature film. And I these stories have parallels because Ava started fairly late as a film director and Robin Gerber started fairly late as a playwright, but she was part of an insider group in Washington, D.C. as a lobbyist. And she knew with her connections there that no less than David Gergen had said that everyone knew that Phil Graham knocked Kay around. So we're telling the story of the domestic violence that she suffered. And it's all women's story in a way that have been through this. And why did they stay? And what does it mean for their psyche? And what does it take to hold on to yourself in those scenarios, especially in an era where people, particularly women of privilege, did not speak about it?
And was that a common story at that point, what she was going through?
I can't say that this. I don't think anybody knew what the stats were because they don't. It wasn't as reported as it is now. But what was common about it is that if you were going through it, that you suffered in silence.
You did not talk about it.
You didn't talk about it, and you didn't really have support because you weren't public about it. So it's an all-female team, the playwright, the director, myself. It's a solo play. I play her. I play her mother. I play Phil, her husband. And we haven't done it in L.A. yet. We won the solo festival in New York, and we've played my alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill Playmakers. We played five different theaters. We'd like to play Palm Springs because it makes sense. So maybe one of the right-sized theaters. It
the
should
Plaza
be an intimate theater. Okay,
it's
great.
Be the
well,
Plaza.
Well, you'll connect
we'll
me
connect
with
you with John Bolton.
Wonderful. That would be my honor.
He does the programming there, and that would be something they would look to.
Have you gotten involved with the theater community here in the Palm Springs area?
No, but as you were talking about the Plaza and the McCallum, it made me remember The Follies. And when I saw it, I was still, you know, I was a Corrine. I mean, I did play Velma in Chicago, but I did a lot of, like, chorus girl stuff. Yeah. And I thought, that's a good goal, to be 70 years old and still huffing
dance.
It. The joy you saw. And as they are talking about now, it's a real good anecdote to mental decline. I mean, I don't want to say it can prevent dementia, but they believe that dancing has great mental benefits, probably because you're learning steps, you're doing it with others, and you know the circulation that you're putting through your body and thus to your brain.
You know, during the pandemic when we were stuck at home, we were on YouTube every day learning to dance for exercise.
Great.
But all sorts of different, and I have never been happier. My wife would just watch me, the giant grin on my face, dancing around the house.
Right.
Yeah. I got to start doing that again.
You know, we didn't just.
I was in better shape then.
Well,
too.
That's good. You can. And I see a Dancing with the with the Stars, maybe calling for you. Would you ever consider? No.
You know, they do one locally, Dancing with the Desert Stars. You could. I'll nominate you.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. This is a goal. This is a good goal.
Yeah.
And
I
maybe would they bring the Follies back? Because
no, unfortunately, because Riff is gone.
Yeah, he was amazing.
He really was amazing.
But you'd have to dance with me.
Okay. We can,
wow, there you go.
Sorry, honey.
Right over there. Your wife is sitting right over
and
there.
And my husband's sitting right over there. And there's a nice space in the center of the floor.
I'm pretty sure my wife would go, oh, you can dance with Sharon Lawrence? I'm okay with that.
Okay.
Now, your husband on the other side, oh, you can dance with Randy Florence? No.
Oh, no. His thumb is up. His thumb is up. He shared me with Andy Sipowicz. He shared me with a lot of folks.
There we go.
Yeah, he knows I belong to him.
There we go. Okay. And I'm just, she played a housewife prostitute on The Desperate Housewives.
That's right.
Her first Broadway role was a prostitute.
Yeah, right.
There has been some typecasting here, hasn't there?
Listen,
I thought I was the one who was going to piss off the guest.
No, you're not going to piss me off. I did an independent feature where I'm having an affair. I play a philosophy professor having an affair with her TA, her teaching assistant. And I thought, haven't I aged out of those kinds of scenes and
not
characters?
Yet. No.
But, you know, representation matters. So as long as I feel that something's tastefully done, I will do it. Even when I'm playing the killers, you know, the people who are, and I played a lot of bad women.
Yeah, yeah.
Bad women. And I, if the character's compelling and I feel like I can make sense out of it, I appreciate the range and the variety. That's what blows my boat.
Is it more fun sometimes to play the heavy? I hear people say that it is.
It is a lot of fun. And sometimes it's fun because you're doing things that you would never allow yourself to do. Your id. You know, when I shot my former oppressor baby daddy point blank on Criminal Minds, it was a wild feeling. It was this Greek sort of Medea kind of quality that you bring up in yourself you never knew you had. And I'm going to go do Steel Magnolias in the spring, and it's the character that I'm playing is Malin, and she is suffering an emotional heartbreak that is, she's one of the good gals, but it's a lot. It's going to call a lot of responsibility of that kind of heartache and that kind of tenderness and telling something that we all can recognize, whether it's false or true. When you're playing these extreme people, how can anybody know whether that's really fake or false or not? Because it's so extreme. How do you know what's in the mind of someone who's that nutty? You can't say they wouldn't do it that way. A serial killer? How are you going to say what a serial killer would or wouldn't do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, I feel so unequipped for any of the acting I was thinking about doing later.
Oh, Randy's an aspiring actor. He's been doing some acting classes and performances and was nominated for a Desert Theater League Award.
You were. Oh, that's wonderful.
He was, indeed.
Well, I'll come see whatever you do. And I don't know when this is going to air, but if
first episode of the new year, so Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Yes. Well, I'll be in New York doing a play in January the 7th through the 18th called Pen Pals, which is really lovely. It's a true story of two gals who were introduced as pen pals when they were 14 years old, one from New York, New Jersey, and one from Sheffield, England, in 1952. I have to get that date right. And they stayed pen pals for 50 years.
Oh, wow.
And it's a rotating cast, like Love Letters. And Maureen McCormick, do you know Maureen McCormick from
Brady Bunch?
The Brady Bunch. She's my partner in it this
time. Oh, that's so cool.
We did it in November. We had such a good time. They've invited us to come back, and we'll be on stage at the Daryl Roth for 2 weeks, January 7th through the 18th. So if your listeners happen to be in the city, of course, most of your listeners are probably here in winter.
Within about 2 miles of the bar.
Most of our listeners are in this room right now. So,
well, Maureen is, she's got a great story to tell. You know, she's somebody you'd like to talk to, I would love to
we'll
make
take
her introduction.
And we've got 6 degrees of separation of the Brady Bunch with Stan Zimmerman.
That's right.
Who wrote the very Brady Christmas.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Sharon, you've been a delight.
Oh, this has
been
amazing.
Thank you so much. This is once again, we've reached a point in the podcast where I wish it was a much longer program.
Or our last episode, because how are we ever going to top this?
Well, we'll have to have her back.
That's how we top it. We bring her back.
Yeah. Or I'll be out here telling a story in some form or another, whether it's a film that's come through your film festival, or whether it's on stage. So cheers to you and what you're
cheers
doing.
Cheers to you.
And
you.
Doing it together. I can tell
an
that's
open
a
invitation.
Pleasure.
Anytime you're in town and you want to be on our podcast, please let us know.
Thank you so much.
We'd be delighted.
And if you watch the film festival next week on the red carpet, Mr. Patrick Evans is the one who's interviewing all of the stars coming across.
Yeah, we do a red carpet. Who,
I know,
do you
I
know who you're talking to this time?
Oh, Andy, Adam Sandler, Kate Hudson, Ethan Hawke.
Oh,
Guillermo del Toro.
I've heard a few of those people.
I think Kieran Culkin.
Kieran McCulkin?
Never again. Never again. There was an issue. I'll tell you about it later. But I think, so with Kate Hudson, I feel almost certain that her presenter is going to be Hugh Jackman. I suspect, I don't know, but maybe George Clooney is going to present to Adam Sandler. So they may be walking the red carpet too. Leo DiCaprio's coming through, but he's not going to stop.
You've got a bunch of free tickets for people like me and my wife, right?
No. No, I'm sorry, I don't. Well, for your wife, possibly.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to be in New York for this. And this sounds, it's a great season for movies. We have a lot to celebrate.
Yeah, we have a lot of good stuff coming up.
Kay and I are going together.
Kay and John are going together. Oh.
Yeah, sorry, Randy.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, guys.
This is terrific. Randy, thank you.
The fact that you responded to my message on Instagram was just awesome. Thank you so much for being here. This is everything I hoped it was going to be.
And me as well. And I'm looking forward to finishing my, shifting from my non-alcoholic beer to a specialty of the little bar. And I hear they have great cheeseburgers. So
the cheeseburger's phenomenal.
Yeah.
You're going to love it.
That's going to be my treat for the first time eating here. But I'll come back.
Good.
Sure. Sharon Lawrence, our guest. Randy Flores, my co-host. John McMullen, our producer. Remember that you can subscribe so you never miss an episode. Our thanks to Skip Page. Our thanks to the McCallum Theater. The team here at the Little Bar always takes great care of us. Subscribe so you never miss an episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar.
Big Conversations, Little Bar is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System. This podcast is available in audio and video format. Visit our website at www.bigconversationslittlebar.com. New episodes are released every Monday.
Athletes and dreamers, stars of the screen, leaders and builders, and all in between. Conversations, little bar, and big conversations, little bar.